Thank you, John. Kathleen and I both worked on the amendments that were proposed by the subcommittee at our last meeting during the past 2 weeks. And I think that this preliminary draft number 3 encompasses all of the changes that were recommended by the subcommittee. Probably the most significant change in the draft, we have taken out the false promise section that previously appeared in there. We have taken out the section covering bad checks, and we have inserted a new section which appears as section 5 in preliminary draft number 3, which covers theft by deception. Now, at the front of your preliminary draft number 3, there are some comments that I've prepared covering that particular section. I felt that the other amendments that were made were self-explanatory and were made really to conform to the thinking of the subcommittee. However, the this section covering theft by deception did require some additional comment, I felt. Now, it's taken largely from the Michigan final draft, section 3201, and the Illinois Criminal Code, section 15-4. It has been modified somewhat by us. For example, in subparagraph 1, phrase "with intent to defraud" appears. This, I think, is desirable in that it makes it clear that, that this section isn't going to deal with an unintentional or an accidental deception, but that there has to be an intent to defraud on the part of the actor. Also, the phrase after impression, the word impression that appears in 1A, section 5, impression of law, value, intention, or other state of mind, has been inserted. This is taken from the Model Penal Code. Clearly shows the intent, I think, of the section to distinguish between representations of fact as contrasted with opinion and present or past fact and as opposed to future events. Some of the distinctions that have created a great deal of difficulty for some of the courts in the past. Now, as I point out in my comments, the rationale of all these codes, whether it's the Illinois Code or Illinois or New York or any of them that have a section dealing either with a false promise or with what is called deception, is what effect the defendant's activities have on the victim. And this section does not cover, and this is picked up separately in the draft, this does not cover the traditional false pretenses as we think of it here in this state, where a false token is required. This would cover oral misrepresentations. And as you go through section 5, you can see that under A, that it would be theft by deception to either create or to confirm another's false impression of law, value, intention, or other state of mind, which the actor does not believe to be true. Now, this confirming could be a confirmation of a false impression that possibly the actor didn't create, but he's aware of it. He's aware that it's not true, but he fails, but he does confirm this false impression. Or under B, if he fails to correct a false impression which he himself has previously created or confirmed, or if he prevents another from acquiring information pertinent to the disposition of the property involved, or if he sells or otherwise transfers or encumbers property, failing to disclose a lien, adverse claim, or other legal impediment to the enjoyment of the property, whether such impediment is or is not valid, or is not a matter of official record, or he promises performance, which he does not intend to perform, or knows will not be performed. Any of these activities would amount to theft by deception if property is obtained thereby, and if these acts are committed with an intent to defraud. Now, under 2, the exception that appears there is taken from section 223.3 of the Model Penal Code. However, the word representations is a new word that Kathleen and I discussed, and we felt that this would be a better word than the word statement that appeared in the Model Penal Code, because it would get at non-oral representations. And of course, this exception is intended to cover the mass communication advertising, statements that would be thought of as commendation of wares that would not be likely to deceive persons of ordinary intelligence in a certain group. If the representations have no pecuniary significance, in other words, assuming that in the course of a transaction the defendant made a statement, for example, say that he knew that the victim was a member of a certain lodge or a group, and in order to induce him to do business with him or something, he misrepresented that he was a member of this group, or he represented a certain organization which he did not. Now, if the victim was, maybe he was misled, but if he did not suffer any pecuniary loss thereby, if he still got what he bargained for, this would not be theft by deception. And this is the type of thing that the draft of the Model Penal Code were trying to carefully keep out of the criminal law area, and it seems to me this is a good thing to have in there, because some of these situations, it would seem, are possibly undesirable, but they don't come up to the stature of being criminal conduct. Now, under sub 3, in any prosecution for theft by deception, the actor's intention or belief that a promise would not be performed shall not be established by or inferred from the fact alone that such promise was not performed. Now, this is taken from the New York Penal Law, language that modifies their section on false promise. And it's to, here again, eliminate a situation where it might be breach of promise, a breach of contract, but it is not the fact that there was non-performance alone, standing alone, would not be sufficient evidence of criminal conduct. As a matter of fact, the New York draft goes considerably farther than that, and uses language that to the effect that the evidence taken as a whole must exclude every reasonable hypothesis of innocence, and the only reasonable hypothesis that can be drawn to a moral certainty is guilt. And it seems to me that that strong language probably isn't required. Since we also have the language, we've made clear that there has to be an attempt to defraud, and also the language here that this standing alone would not be sufficient evidence, although this is something I'm sure we'll want to discuss. Now, the rest of the draft, and we can, however you want to do this, we can go through and pick up the changes that have been made to conform with the recommendations that were made by the subcommittee. Of course, in Section 1, the definition of property has been reinserted. It was inadvertently left out last time. That appears on page 2 of the draft, sub 5. Property means any article, substance, or thing of value, including but not limited to, and this is the new language that was approved by the subcommittee at the meeting before last. Not limited to money, tangible and intangible, personal property, real property, chosen action, evidence of debt or contract.
What's a chosen action?
Well, this would be a an intangible legal right that I'm not asked the judge to define it better, but an intangible legal right where would be a good example.
Well, as I recall, it seems to me like this embezzlement case that where the woman stole checks. And they had the authorized signature of the Red Cross organization, and they had the authorized signature of the president of the organization. And she took these checks and cashed them and took the money in part to use it to pay her own bills with. Well, as I recall, these were referred to as chosen action, the check. It's a right to recover the money on the check. And by inserting the word chosen action in there, it includes a number of intangible things of this kind that in a sense defy accurate or detailed definition, but doesn't let someone escape because they can't say to you, well, you defined precisely what it was I stole.
Well, and the thing itself,
that isn't a very good definition.
The check piece of paper has no particular value. The thing stolen had no particular value, but it represents a right.
The legal right, you see, is encompassed in it.
I would think it would have been something, any old thing you can sue to get your money if it doesn't work out.
Right. If it's any kind of a potential claim that you might be able to assert against the person.
Can we go back to the word promise? Has any problem about what promise means?
Section 5.
Yeah,
there's two or three words in there that I'm sure.
Yeah, and I wasn't meaning to cut off any discussion on this. I thought just as preliminary remarks, I might go back through these others, but if you want to discuss this one section first, it doesn't matter.
If I could suggest, Bruce Bowling has been over everything in here except Section 5. And if we could, I intended to defer consideration of Section 5 until 11 when he got here.
Okay.
And we're going to have to get into this, and we're going to have to throw it around. It just might prolong it if we go into it in detailed form now. It should be noted, I think, Don, with respect to Section 1, that was approved in its entirety at the last subcommittee meeting, with the exception of adding the definition of property.
Yes, and of course, now sub 6 is new. Receiving stolen property is new, inasmuch as we were directed to redraft the section on receiving. This is part of that. The definition of receiving stolen property.
It was formerly in the section on stolen property.
Yeah.
And I was the one that made the suggestion that it be put into definitions, and I'm not so sure by reflection that I was right, and I want to discuss that.
Well, the rule that we use in drafting, we've adopted, but for what it's worth, is that if a term is used only in one section, is the tendency to put the definition in that section. If it's used many places, like property is used or obtained is used in many different places, and this then to put it in a general definition section at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the rule followed when that was placed in the single section.
Right. Well, we want to get into that because I do recall, and you recall, I'm sure too, that it was me who made the suggestion. And the others went along, and now I'm not so sure I'm right. But we'll go over we'll go over every section with the exception of 5. Proceed when you conclude your preliminary remarks, Don.
All right. Under Section 2, it's has been amended. In the following manners, under sub 1, that has been changed to this extent. The language obtaining property by false pretenses has been taken out and has and reappears as a separate subsection. Also, later on in the, as it's referred to, it appears in section 6. Now, the reason we did that was in view of the vote of the subcommittee to make sure that we clearly indicated that a false token was required, and that was the primary reason for doing it this way. And of course, this is something we're going to have to discuss further, the section on obtaining of false pretenses. Kathleen and I discussed at some length, and this was one way of handling it, we felt, was to Kathleen suggested that we remove obtaining by false pretenses from sub 1 if we were going to have it appear as a separate section, as a separate individual manner of committing theft. And hopefully this will accomplish that, although I'm going to want to discuss that some length possibly. The rest of this section is, and then is pretty much the same as it was before. In fact, it is the same except for sub 6. Receiving stolen property appears in section 7. Section 3 is the same as it was before. It was approved the last meeting. Theft by extortion. We have some minor changes in that section. Under the first paragraph, the language "in the future" appears on the fifth line of that paragraph. That was recommended at the last meeting to clearly show that this is a threat to do harm or cause physical injury in the future, not imminently.
Does "will" mean in the future?
Well,
maybe I'm sorry. Maybe this was something.
Right. We went over that. But it wasn't really cleared up in my mind.
No. And we suggested that it be amended to read "in the future." Kathleen pointed out that "will" meant "in the future" and that it was redundant. We made the amendment. I'm inclined to think that we didn't need to make the amendment now after I look at this.
The problem there, Mr. Chairman, is robbery. You are standing with a gun saying "your money or your life," and the threat, of course, is "in the future." 20 seconds from now, I'm going to shoot you if you don't pull your wallet out, but you have a problem in the future. I think it's an effort to emphasize that it was sometime off in the distance.
You differentiate.
Accomplish it or not.
If you shot the gun off, why, the threat's pretty much past your desk.
Well,
you're not
the robbery
worried about
was
the threat anymore.
Well, armed with a dangerous weapon, though, you see. Yeah. So the distinction is that's robbery and this is extortion.
Yeah.
You know, both of them have an implied threat.
In other words, what we wanted to do was make sure that we didn't have a section here that would be equally applicable with the crime of robbery to a certain set of facts.
Yeah, I see that point.
Page 6 of the minutes, the fourth paragraph, relates to the discussion that we had concerning this.
Well, supposing that a fellow comes to you and says, "If you don't do so and so in 10 minutes, I'm going to go to the newspaper and tell about your terrible past." Is that the present, or is that extortion, or
well,
is that?
Well, premeditation can take place in a split second. Murder, well, I don't see why the time element is going to be.
Now, in that instance, it would clearly be extortion because you don't have the element of threat to do bodily harm. I think that.
So there would be, you'd be able to split it out and write a complaint that would.
But if a man comes up to you and he has a gun, and or even if he doesn't have a gun, if he says that I want you to give me your money, or I'm going to shoot you, that would be robbery. It'd be clearly robbery. But it's a threat to do bodily harm, and a threat to do bodily harm to this person could be extortion. If it's a threat to do harm to him in the future, if he says, you pay me $500 or you won't live till sundown, you see, that gets to be in the extortion area then.
It says, deliver the property to a third person by means of instilling you may fear that if the property is not so delivered, the actor or another will in the future.
And the way it was in the preliminary draft, in draft number 2, the actor or another will, (1), cause physical injury to some person in the future, or cause damage to property, or engage in some other conduct constituting a crime. Now, the prepositional phrase in the future modified only causing physical injury, and it was our thought that it should modify each. Yes.
I might point out, I don't necessarily agree with that. I don't think it needs to modify all of them, because I think it. But at the same, I don't think it hurts anything to have it modifying all of them. But I think what you're trying to get at really is (1), cause physical injury to some person, because that's the area where there could possibly be confusion between extortion and robbery.
Well, what?
Yeah.
What if it were deleted in its entirety? Would the same effect be achieved?
Well, I think if we delete it entirely, we're back to the problem. If we say that if the property is not delivered, the actor or another will cause physical injury to some person, that could be a definition of robbery, could it not? Now,
in sub 1, really the only place you needed is.
Well, that was my thinking.
Yeah.
Initially, I'll have to admit I haven't changed my opinion there, but. At the same time, I don't think it does any violence to the section by any other way.
Then we had we'll discuss this when we move on it. Then we had a change with respect to, or some rather lengthy discussion with respect to sub 6, right?
Yes.
So section 6 is new, is it not, in the preliminary draft on page 5, draft 3. No, it is not.
No. What page are you on?
Page 3.
No, page 5.
Oh, the whole section 6 other than subsection 6.
No.
Well, yes, it's new, and of course it was referred to, as I indicated, in our section 1. I have placed it here as a separate section, and this is to spell out that he obtains property by false pretenses when he uses a false token, pretense, or device. This is not as extensive as our present language in ORS 165205. But I think for purposes of theft, and to clearly show that a false token is required, that this would be sufficient, inasmuch the only thing we really want to accomplish here, at least that was my impression from the last meeting, was to eliminate the requirement for, or to avoid eliminating, I should say, to avoid eliminating the requirement for a false token if you're going to charge theft by false pretenses.
Yeah.
find me a copy of a set of words and phrases so I'll know what all these things are. That's a false token.
Well, this would be a something tangible that the defendant has used in inducing the victim to part with the property, something that the victim has relied upon. For example, a bad check.
Right.
A bad check or a
termite eaten shingle.
Yeah.
That's my claim to fame.
Well, we talked about this last time and we discussed, and I kind of swung over to Bruce Pauling's side on this, about the necessity for a false token. Because of the in such a gray area and there are so many, we're so close to the civil law on the thing that I begin to worry about just why don't we need a false token. And so they redrafted it on the basis of our instruction.
Now here's the thing. Now with our new section on theft by deception, if you have a misrepresentation without false token, not a false token, and the state wants to prosecute on that basis, then of course they would be free and they could go ahead without the false token and charge theft by deception under our section 6, or in section 4, 5.
Your problem there would be proof, probably. Your difficulty is convincing the court.
That's the major difference between section 6 and section 5.
Actually, the kind of misrepresentation you're talking about.
Yes, really.
Well, I was wondering if you want to eliminate token out of the thing, if you, in section 5, under, say for instance, under 1A, that he creates or confirms another false impression of law, comma, fact, comma, value, intention. For instance, the termite eaten board was a false impression of fact.
Well, we concluded at the last meeting that we should not eliminate the requirement for a false token. You know this, Justice Sloan, possibly Bob doesn't. Oregon law presently provides that upon trial for having, by any false pretense, obtained the signature of any person to any written instrument, or obtained from any person any valuable thing, no evidence can be admitted of a false pretense expressed orally and unaccompanied by a false token or writing. In other words, the law requires, as a matter of proof now, that the oral misrepresentation in and of itself is not sufficient. It has to be accompanied by some tangible evidence, and the reference that Kathleen made related to a famous termite case where all there was by way of a token was the board that reportedly had been. I anticipate some discussion revolving around sections 5 and 6 and whether or not there is a redundancy there. But I just to move on real quickly, so we can go through this section by section numerically.
Section 7 is substantially as it was before, except that in accordance with the views of the subcommittee, conceals has been inserted. And we have taken the definition of stolen or receiving from there and placed it at the beginning with the other definitions. Section 8 is the same. That was approved earlier. In the value section, there are, I believe there's one minor change. in 2A, the value of an instrument constituting an evidence of death, including but not limited to, and that's the language, shall be deemed the amount due or collectible thereby or thereon, and the balance of that sentence that previously appeared has been deleted. Language defect, which was noticed previously there, was the effect that which ordinarily would be the face amount thereof, less any amount that had been satisfied. Defenses is the same as it was before. Now, are there any others there, Kathleen, that that's new that I may have missed?
Well, I think we changed from the value of property cannot satisfactorily to cannot be reasonably.
Yeah, reasonably. Yeah, that's right.
Consistent with the terminology elsewhere.
Okay, let's go back to Section 1. If Section 1 was approved in its entirety by the subcommittee at its last meeting, and the staff was asked to include the definition of property, which appears in Sub 5. Now, I have a question myself with respect to the propriety of receiving stolen property appearing there. I think that we should reserve our discussion of that until we get over to Section 7, which relates to stolen property. So I'm wondering if any of us have any comments with respect to Section 1 now before we move its approval.
I have a comment with respect to subsection 5, which I've noticed two or three other places here, and I did this once before at one of the meetings, and it was thought that this could be handled by a general statement someplace, perhaps as refers to the whole code, and that's this expression, including but not limited to. And then specifying certain items. It has been, as you know, an accepted rule of construction in statutes of this kind for such a long time that these specifics, that the specifics govern the general. And that,
having named the specifics, you eliminate the general.
You tend to eliminate the general. And now it may be that by inserting in, when you get to the entire code, a rule of construction to be applied, this shall not be the rule.
You mean this code shall be interpreted as broadly as possible, or
right, or the expression including but not limited to does not mean that the specific items mentioned are exclusive and shall not be construed to limit the general terms and so forth.
Well, of course, the reason for using the phrase but not limited to instead of just including, which is used in some statutes, is an effort not to foreclose the general.
I realize, but that is never necessarily.
No, and even if you do go slightly to the general, you still stay within the same category. If you say including but not limited to dogs and cats,
yeah.
Somebody
but
says,
see, what
well,
I wonder is
small domesticated animals of a household type, and it wouldn't include a tiger.
Would it include horses or tigers?
See, yeah. Well,
horses you might debate, but tigers you're pretty sure are being out of.
The things that you have listed are the things that are obviously property. So why can't you just say property means any article, substance, or thing of value?
Well, now,
I suppose, could you go back in part to the old common law rule that, for instance, that didn't apply to real property? I think not in the ancient tradition.
No, it didn't. That's right. It didn't apply to
personal
property. And it was limited.
I hope you escaped from some of those.
Well, one of the interesting things, and without any reflection on the intelligence, sagacity, all this sort of thing, of course, it's kind of interesting to note that with the New York Code, where they went for the very broad approach, that the Supreme Court has been putting back in some of these things. I think in partly a reaction that they got maybe too broad. for instance, in their false pretenses, they don't make any mention whatever of a token, but the court has said, well, we're still going to, yeah, that's, you haven't said enough to indicate to us that you didn't intend that to be in, so we still work those things.
Well, this is why at some place in the thing, you're going to have to make some very definite and specific rules on construction. And I just raised that question because it's
what you're saying is if the rules are spelled out in general at the start of the code, then we've eliminated the need for the specifics thereafter.
It may be that I certainly wouldn't for 1 minute propose to be a draftsman or that I know anything about it, but I just have a rather strong feeling on this, including but not limited to, because almost invariably you immediately mention the things that are obvious, like property.
The problem is in getting to the
unusual type of thing.
Well,
that may or may not be property, and having these limited things doesn't help you any, and it tends to cause the courts in construing it to mean, well, this is the kind of thing you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. In other words, with the court saying the court pays more attention to limited than it does to including.
That's right.
Well, I'd have to disagree with you, Justice Sloan, that we have mentioned things here that are obviously property. I don't think we have mentioned, now some of them obviously are property, but in the historical context of larceny, as it has been construed through the years by the courts, some of these things that appear in here have not been looked upon as obviously property.
This is true.
That's true.
For example, this tangible and intangible distinction. That's the Tauscher case.
The tangible or intangible is certainly properly includable.
Yeah. And as Kathleen pointed out, real property. Of course, it's covered in our statute now. The definition of property includes real property.
I don't want to debate the issue, but I just feel that this is a thing that in some place, when the whole thing is put together, either by rule of construction or some way, the problem I mentioned must be eliminated.
The problem that, the question that you raised, I think is a good question because it's going to aid the court in construing the applicability.
The way you people intended that it should be.
Correct. If in the general provisions to the criminal statute there is a rule of construction indicating that including but not limited to doesn't follow the rule of just and generous, is it?
Whatever it is.
Yeah. You probably know that. That's my first year Latin. Right. But I think also part of the intent on the drafters here was to, as closely as possible, follow the guidelines set down by New York and Michigan and the model penal code so that the court, if a question arises, seeing that we employ the same language here as the model penal code, can go to the model penal code and its commentaries in order to resolve the question. I don't know who's handling these sections, or what subcommittee is handling the general provisions. Has that been assigned?
Yes, that's number two.
We better make a note of that.
There's quite a
difference
of opinion in the drafters of these various codes, too, as to what that general policy should be. Some of them have stated, follow the general old rule that anything to do with criminal law to be narrowly construed. And adopt a kind of a common law rule on that, but I noticed that a couple of them have taken the other view and have stated in their general statement, about section 4 of their whole code indicating which position they wish to take on this. And in Connecticut, I noticed they took one position, and then the position is expressed in about that much, and then the next 7 pages are describing the fight they got as they're trying to decide where to go.
The thing I'm wondering, if we, is it within the purview of this committee to make strong enough recommendations to the commission as a whole so that we can feel safely that a rule of construction which would eliminate the need for this sort of thing would be a adopted, or else we'd have to go back and do some additions and corrections and stuff to things we've already approved and perhaps gotten approved by the commission.
I think it's certainly within our purview to make these recommendations, and I think we're working with this, and we can crystallize a problem for them. I don't anticipate that would be a problem.
No, and I certainly anticipate that this problem of construction of the penal code will be covered by these other subcommittees that are dealing with the preliminary general articles. And of course, as a project director, I'll be sitting in with these other subcommittees as they go through their drafts, as well as this subcommittee.
They're all going to be confronted with it.
Sure.
The reason I ask is a model code that property is anything about it, including real estate, tangible and intangible personal property, contract rights, chosen action, and other interest in or claims to wealth, admission, or transportation tickets, captured or domestic animals, food, drink, electric, or other power. You know, it's pretty hard to think of something that doesn't fall within anything of value, which is pretty broad in itself, and then going through and it was broad enough already, and then they added chosen action, which covers a lot of more things. They've avoided having to go to the including but not limited to.
Well, you notice they didn't use the word including in that. Well, the reason that we use the but not limited to is the effort to try and get around this doctrine of a justum generis. This is not an all-inclusive list. We're just suggesting to you some of the things that might be.
Yes, now this definition that appears in our draft is patterned largely from the New York Penal Code, except that in light of our State versus Tauscher case, I had inserted this tangible and intangible phrase in there because
that isn't essential to be in there.
I mean, this was something that maybe some other states might not have had a problem with, but it was obvious that Oregon did have a problem. But I felt that the other definitions were broad enough to cover most things. And also, because you have to read this section in context.
Yeah,
and
with each of the others.
Yes, and under our general definitions, for example, the definition for obtain, it includes, but not limited to, the bringing about of a transfer or purported transfer of property, say, and this would take care of the constructive acquisition of, say, real property.
I noticed that this wasn't the only place that but not limited to was included.
No, there's three or four places.
And,
other places.
I was wondering whether it could be handled in the manner Justice Sloan suggests.
At least you'd refer to me as Gordon to this.
Right. I think the judge is pretty formal, you know.
If you're through with that, I have another question on this one, and that is the phrase evidence of debt or contract. Now, does evidence refer both to debt and contract, or do you mean
the intent was for it to apply to both?
In which case, an and after shows an action and an or might have been helpful.
If that would be a question that would.
I think there should be.
By students of law, but I think any student of English should say that it refers to debt, evidence of debt or evidence of contract. I think evidence of would be implied.
Well, that was the intent.
Unless you were defending somebody at that point, then you'd argue like that. It's only the contract by gum and not just the evidence of it.
This is a fairly common type of thing.
I'm sure. You know, for every fellow you get on one side, you can find one on the other.
Why don't we amend that by putting after action the word and? No, wait a minute. Property means any article, substance, or thing of value, including not limited to money, tangible, and intangible, real property, chosen action,
and evidence of debt.
And evidence of debt, or Well, no, I think maybe it's all right the way it is. But
well, the only problem is the way it's set up. If you're going to use a joiner and or, I don't know which one you want to use. It seems to me appropriately there should be one in there, or else the word contract does tend to stand alone. You see, because
that's
in the
right.
enumeration you usually add a
that's right.
disjunctive or conjunctive on the last before the last.
Well, we can make it
absolutely clear what you'd add.
Another evidence
or you add another evidence of.
Yes, right.
Yeah, or just of.
Evidence of debt
or of contract.
Yeah.
Do it that way.
Yeah.
Get, I think, that same effect.
Right. Motion on that, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
I still
move. Okay. All in favor of the amendment inserting of, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Now, we have any other discussion with respect to section 1 excluding sub 6 thereof? If not, I think we're ready for a motion to pass section 1, and I maybe we can, if there is any more discussion, we won't move its adoption until we come back to it from talking about receiving. Now, section 2, you'll recall at the last full committee meeting, there was some extended discussion with respect to substituting the word theft for the word larceny, commenced to employ theft rather than larceny in our new code. And we kind of left it at that. In the first couple of drafts that we've had of this subcommittee, we employed the word larceny. And the last subcommittee meeting, I guess it was principally me, that suggested that we go to the use of the word theft. Getting ourselves completely away from the old common law usages, and I felt that it was particularly applicable when we start talking about theft by deception and theft by false pretenses. It's complicated when you say larceny by deception, larceny by false pretenses. So we've got a preliminary policy decision to make right now, I think, if we're going to stick by the use of the word theft. We never formally moved that last time.
Obviously, in anticipation of that, we, as right. you can see, used theft through this third draft rather than larceny.
Well, that was just giving a feeling what the change would look like.
Well, the value in it, of course, is in this idea we discussed earlier. The full commission is reduce the number of crimes so that we don't have to sit there and learn that larceny and theft really mean the same thing. And are almost the same thing, except in a few cases. and generally falls in our idea of trying to simplify things as much as possible.
Yeah, I think it does. I think it's a more comprehensive definition because it isn't subject to the inhibitions that larceny is. Now, maybe I'm wrong.
Well, the new codes in these other states have gone both ways. Some of them have stayed with larceny, and some have gone with theft.
It is probably the more generally accepted layman's understanding of it. But one of the problems we found we ran into was both theft and larceny, and that is neither one of them have verb. So you always have to use a he commits theft because you don't have a he thieves. He steals, and then you've gotten into another. Another word, larceny,
of course,
has the same drawback. So.
But then you
get into a
question with the use of larceny, and you say he steals and or takes, steals, and carries away, and you talk about take has construed as meaning aspiration, and I don't know. But do you want to, the folk may might reverse us on this, but do you want to stick with the use of the word theft?
I might point out that, the New York approach, they have gone both ways on theirs. Now, their basic section dealing with larceny, common law larceny and obtaining and embezzlement is called larceny. But then you get over into their other offenses, the other larcenous types of offenses, and the word theft is used. Theft of services, the possession of stolen property comes under theft. Misapplication of property, unauthorized use of a vehicle is all designated as theft. Now, I'm not clear in my own mind why they did it that way, but...
well, does a common law heritage, the word larceny, does it really mean something unique and different from theft?
I don't think so, really. I think when you think of larceny, you think of stealing, and you think of stealing, you think of a person who steals is a thief.
But there's a problem there.
Sure.
He may be a thief, but he may have done it by burglary, larceny,
or
robbery.
That's true. True.
Yeah,
he could be a.
Yeah. Well, if I know this word, I think around our courthouse that the idea of converting to the idea of a general theft statute, using the word theft now for what little this means, seems to have an appealing idea. It may be psychological, as you suggested. It has, I think, a little more temptation to it to recognize you're breaking away from the older concepts and the technicalities and all the things that have grown into the field of larceny, that if you just abolish the word larceny, it would have at least some greater chance of eliminating that.
That might help with the tendency to express by the New York court of putting some of those
back
things
into
back in when you change the term and say, well, we're not talking about our old larceny statute, we're talking about our new statute.
The only thing that sticks in my mind is there must have been some reason why New York did that. Why they made the breakdown.
Well, if they had a particular reason, it doesn't appear in their commentary. Of course, they stuck with the terminology that they had traditionally used, except when they got into the newer areas such as theft of services, then they called it theft. But they stayed with the traditional word larceny, and that section on larceny deals with what we would traditionally think of as larceny, although they have encompassed within it embezzlement and obtaining under false pretenses. Of course, as you relate your code to your case law in your state, all your cases talk and the definitions and the construction that's been placed has been placed on larceny. These codes where you're codifying law that is case law, it could be that they felt that it's more comfortable to stay with a word that was familiar to everyone and just expand the scope of the word. And that, frankly, that was my initial thinking on this when I did the first draft on this, that this might be the best approach to use a familiar word but just expand its meaning. I have to admit, I'm coming around to the other way of thinking now. I think that the idea of, if we're going to have a new code, start with a new word and a fresh approach, and so it will indicate that this is a break with the traditional concepts.
The easy explanation to the New York situation, Mr. Elder, might be the two different subcommittees drafted.
I see. Okay.
Well, what happened in Illinois, as a matter of fact,
and
it's very apparent.
It's no more important than that.
Well, I say that's an explanation, but in Illinois, this did happen. It was drafted by different subcommittees, and one of which finished earlier, and the drafters were able to spend a great deal more time polishing it. The first part of their code is much smoother than the last part. The last part gets a little rocky in places, and it shows the lack of polish and time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm looking at this
And if there isn't any objection, we'll proceed and employ the word theft, and the sole committee is going to have to pass this anyway. Now, let me interject something at this point. On the last two subcommittee meetings that we had, we started at 9:30, and we had coffee and here, and the consensus was that we should just go till we finished, and we went the first one, I think, until about 2, and the last one, the last subcommittee meeting, we went till about 3. Members didn't want to interrupt the subcommittee meeting by going out for lunch. Now, unless any of you have arrangements to the contrary for lunch, I proposed to Dawn that I'd have somebody bring some sandwiches in, and we could just work through. We wouldn't be famished, and that way we could wrap it up earlier than if we went till broke for an hour. And then, is that all right?
It's fine. I got a 5 a.m. to 7 p.m. day on this anyway.
So then, all right. Okay. Well, then I'll.
Did you wing over the sign?
No. It was supposed to be a front go through here about noon. I don't know if we'd been done by noon. Well, I'd been willing to fly. And then after that, of course, I'd be between here and Ben. So.
Well, I want you to know he was exaggerating when he said they were finished.
One solution to that.
We gave you all kinds of donuts.
There's only one solution to that problem, and that is not have so many lawyers on the committee, and you can finish earlier. That's the only solution.
Well, did you get some?
Yeah, I don't know. I've never found that the Judiciary Committee was any slower than any of the other ones that I've ever worked with.
They really move much more quickly.
Maybe he can help.
And considering the number of bills that they have and everything, oh gosh. The Judiciary Committee in the House of these have filed bills, and they do it pretty rapidly, a little too rapidly sometimes.
Okay.
Some bad things come out of the Judiciary Committee.
Well, in the Senate, the Judiciary, we attempted to proceed
so
with
don't really have
all
the
we
have a better system over there.
We tried to proceed with all deliberate speed.
The Senate comes out with their bills about 2 weeks after the session ends.
And it's room 1200.
The Senate Judiciary Committee has to make bills that aren't necessarily judiciary bills.
I think sometimes when they look at a bill and they're quite sure what category it comes in, they figure, well, the judiciary can figure it out. Give it to them. You have more bills that would put together for me than ways and, other than Ways and Means, because they're joint.
That's right. On page 4 of the subcommittee minutes, right at the very top, and I'm making reference now to section 2 on page 2 of draft 3. It said we agreed that the subsection should be combined, and that they agreed as it's recited there, and you say wrongfully takes, obtains, withholds such property from an owner thereof in any one of the following ways.
Including but not limited. I don't think we could insert that there. I think we'd have a constitutional problem if we did that.
On section 2 here of preliminary draft 3, you just said any of the following ways. Now, the fact that the one was apparently inadvertently omitted makes a difference.
Yeah, that's my error, leaving out the one. It was inadvertent.
Well, does it make any difference?
Make any difference.
Does it?
Any implied signal?
All right. I think it's just as well without it. But I wanted to bring that up. Okay. Now, we had some discussion previously with respect to sub 1 of section 2, that theft, a person commits theft when he does any of these things by conduct known prior to the effective date of this act as common law larceny by trespassory taking, common law larceny by trick or embezzlement. We had some questions with respect to pleading as far as that was concerned. And then we pretty much concluded that it was okay, just delete the false pretense part, which you've done and put in later. Page 3 in the minutes relate the discussion that we had. Are you satisfied, Don and Kathleen, from your research of this, that it's okay to leave it the way it is, the way you've done it? You're not.
I still have the same problem that I had the last time, which I think Professor Arthur articulated more elegantly than I can, but why are those different than what you've described as your general, your descriptions in 2 through 6? Seems to me that the common law larceny, in both types, embezzlement, I'm not so sure of, but the common law larceny is covered in 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6. And I looked, and I don't know whether Don was sold on it, but I looked at the commentary from the state that used that technique of throwing that in, and I just didn't have the feeling that they could, to my satisfaction, justified why they included it. So I still ask the question, what are you covering in 1 that you haven't covered in 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6?
Well, I'm not sure that you're covering anything that isn't covered subsequently in these other sections. And I also have been unable to find a satisfactory explanation in these comments, except that as you go back to the early drafts of the Model Penal Code, the intent was, and I think the intent of the draftsmen in these others, in the states that have revised their codes, is to set forth in their theft or larceny statute a section that consolidates clearly to indicate that this is a consolidation type of statute, and that this is almost a statement of purpose within this, that within the statute or within the draft, to show a consolidation here of crimes that were previously called something else that are now in larceny or theft.
Yeah, but what I can't help wondering is whether they've got some particular problems in their states based on, you know, that they have retained these, because these are all eastern states, you know, that they felt the need to incorporate or retain something because it had existed in their law, maybe in their court law rather than their statute law.
Well,
and if they were trying to, you know, glom onto that and say, we don't mean to get rid of that. But in Oregon, I don't know, I'm just kind of, the embezzlement one is not the one I'm just kind of, you know, lifting my eyebrow at. The other two, the common law larceny ones. Because a common law larceny by trick, it seems to me, is more than covered either under false pretenses or under deception. If I understand, I remember what common law larceny by trick.
You
aren't worried about common law larceny or trespassory taking, are you? Those are necessary, aren't they?
Common law
larceny
by trespassory
taking. And it seems to me that's still covered, because we haven't said anything about the... isn't this taking involving improper or unauthorized entry as opposed to burglary? I mean,
there's
a distinction between burglary and trespassory. Yeah. What I wonder is if by adding those 2, we caught anybody that you wouldn't have caught under or been able to prosecute properly under one of your other.
Well,
I don't really have the answer clearly. But
well, I'm not so sure, Kathleen, in looking at this, whether sub 2 through 6 would cover just the flat out old stealing.
Yeah.
But
we want to make
or you don't have
clear.
Deception. If you just steal something, where would we have it covered under our section 2?
What we want to make crystal clear is that we're not eliminating these other crimes that historically have existed in Oregon.
In other words,
you mean like the pickpocketer, that's a trespassory taking, isn't it? Trespassory taking.
Well, sure, that would be a trespassory taking, or if I think that almost any of your larcenies where you take and carry away the property of another is a trespassory taking. You're trespassing into the possessory rights.
On
you're
somehow to get the get at the property.
Larceny from a store.
Yeah, or whatever. But then I guess my answer is, wouldn't you be better off to write a section to cover that instead of trying to incorporate it by reference to a common law thing that, most of us can't remember the definition of without going looking up the text?
Well, now, trespassory, I think, at least my interpretation of trespassory in the cases, this is trespass to possessory rights. That's what
it
means.
Yeah, right. But
not trespass to real property or something like that.
Well, but as I was thinking, the pickpocket, you've got the... Well, that's part of the problem that I'm not sure about, and that's why I'm not sure that there shouldn't be a section that says, by conduct described in Section 4 of this Act, and then describe what the taking was.
That's my wondering on the thing. We've got three crimes defined, really, in subsection 1. Common law larceny by trespassory taking, common law larceny by trick. Well, it seems to me the trick and deception are getting off close to each other. Or embezzlement. There's only three crimes involved. We've gone through in the balance of the thing, and we define extortion. We've defined theft, defined deception, we've defined lost or mislaid or delivered to the wrong addressee or any of these other things. Rather than just leave a blanket common law larceny by trespassory taking, why can't we define common law larceny by trespassory taking in some other words as to actually what common law larceny by trespassory taking is and put it in?
Well, it seems to me that one of the things that we want to get away from is over-defining, and I say this particularly with respect to embezzlement. We presently have about 9 or 11 different types of embezzlement statutes, and it was our intent in formulating the comprehensive theft statute to define what theft is comprehensively without getting into particular definitions of embezzlement, because you get what we're talking about, what Judge Sloan was talking about. You define one and not the other, maybe you're excluding one. So this was kind of a catch-all, wasn't it? Wasn't that your thought?
It's a transitional entirely, isn't it? To be sure that you've covered all your bases that we're leaving back here someplace.
Right. What I look at is all these things up in here, and I don't know how many different definitions of embezzlement you're going to get if you go through all those. This is the thing that bothers me. I agree that the thing should be broad enough so that I'm not looking for it as a way for somebody to discover something and say, well, unless you can prove this, why there is no embezzlement. At the same time, I'm not familiar enough with criminal law to know that whether or not these three things, it would appear to me that these three crimes stated in here cover an awful broad spectrum.
Well, if you would take in theft, where you say a person commits theft when, with the intent to deprive another of property or appropriate property to himself or to a third person, he wrongfully takes, obtains, or holds such property from the owner thereof, period. Now, what then is not included in that statement?
This is,
well, what's not included is the manner in which he's done it.
Well, but which one of these then specifics? I would assume, again, without going to a bunch of definitions, that it would include everything that you include in paragraph 1 and some more too.
That's pretty broad.
When you look back at problems,
well,
one of the problems I think John mentioned at one of the earlier meetings is that you'd had, or somebody, I think it was John, on the taking of a rented automobile. You go in and rent an automobile and go off on a joyride. at what point does this become a theft of some kind? We had a case the other day on credit cards.
We're going to have two specific sections later that we're going to, part of which we're going to cover today.
Well, what I was wondering is that can you view it from the point of view of taking an all-inclusive general definition, as you have here, would seem to me like, under theft, in this first paragraph, and then decide which of these particular acts are not included in that? It would seem to me like that, for instance, that within that, I would include the taking a rented automobile and withholding it from the owner thereof. Then becomes a question which you eventually have to decide, which is what would be the question involving any, say, a rented automobile, is at what point in time did he intend to withhold it?
Well, now, are you suggesting that...
What I'm suggesting is that kind of thing eliminates, at least to me, the vice of this number one is this retention of any thought that previously, the previous technicalities that have existed in the law of larceny and so forth, and embezzlement and so on, no longer exist.
What it says now is that we're incorporating by reference.
Oh, right. And what I, at least to me, if when this is completed, that I would, my own point of view strictly would be, is that you could almost say the case law up to this date is abolished. This is a new slate. This is what we start with. We don't look back and see the technical implications that have grown into 100 of these cases. Deciding what is this and what is that, and, well, you can't be guilty of this because he didn't stick his hand in through the window far enough, things of this kind. But if it's possible to put it as much as possible into some kind of a general definition of this, and then if there is conceivably types of taking and withholding that are not included in that, make specific reference to it. But that's just my concept.
One way over there, I think. But won't we set up a situation where there'll be a lot of new cases that will need to be decided?
Oh, of course. Yeah. Of course. You're going to have that anyway. But just the more you can abolish going back.
Yeah, changing paragraph 5, subsection 5, is going to create some new things to go into the courts, some new appellate decisions. But the thing that bothers me is lumping together what looks to me to be a fairly large bunch of conduct and saying that this was too tough for us, so we're just going to let all the old things apply to that. And then, but these other things aren't that tough. We know what extortion means. We can say what extortion is, but we can't say what embezzlement is. Or we can't say what common law larceny by trick is. Now, this is the, if we can do it for sections 2 through 6, we may wind up with, instead of 1 through 6, we may wind up with 1 through 8 by adding something that defines common law larceny by trespass already taken as number 1, common law larceny by trick is number 2, embezzlement is number 3, and then acquiring property lost so forth and so on becomes 4, and we wind up adding 2 more sections.
The present, something we're going to have to wrestle with here and figure out. The present section, general section on larceny in the Oregon Code says, a person who steals the property of another, or who willfully takes, carries, leads, or drives away the property of another with intent to deprive such other of such property permanently is guilty of larceny. All right. Period. Now, there they're defining larceny. We're endeavoring to include in our definition of theft something that's not only larceny, but something that heretofore has been obtaining money by false pretenses, that heretofore, in Oregon law at least, has been extortion, something that heretofore has been embezzlement. Now, the way the Model Penal Code handled this, they set out a section and it said consolidation of theft offenses. And they said conduct denominated theft in this article constitutes a single offense embracing the separate offenses heretofore known as larceny, embezzlement, false pretense, extortion, blackmail, fraudulent conversion, receiving stolen property, and the like. And then et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, what we're trying to do is we're trying to consolidate the theft offenses. Is this not right?
Yes, precisely.
All right. Now, there has to be somewhere in our statutory definitions a statement of intent to consolidate the theft offenses. I mean, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. Whether by embracing everything like we've partially done in sub one here, when the resurrects some old ghosts, whether that's the right thing to do, I don't know. I'm a little bit intrigued by the suggestion that we put a period after the owner thereof. But I think also that we've got to make some policy declaration with respect to consolidation of the offenses.
Well,
mechanically, how we're going to do it, I don't know.
We've got two choices then, don't we? We either have to do, as I read this 164 of the Model Penal Code, we're going to have to...
164?
Page 164, 223.1.
Yeah, right.
We are going to have to expand subsection 1 or to point out this is an intention to consolidate offenses and that there are certain offenses that we're not going to define, or else we have to eliminate it and redefine the ones that we intended to cover.
Well, of course, that was the purpose of sub 1, was this consolidation of these offenses. Your traditional larceny and larceny by trick and embezzlement. And as in our initial draft, we had obtaining also under that section. But the whole purpose, of course, in this and the purpose that of the Model Penal Code was to was this unification of these offenses. And their comments in their tentative draft 2 state that unification is desirable because it eliminates pointless procedural obstacles to the conviction of thieves and swindlers. It will no longer be possible, for example, to reverse a conviction of larceny by trick by satisfying an appellate court that the defendant had been guilty of a different offense, obtaining by false pretense, or to upset a fraud conviction on the ground that the defendant intends to frighten rather than deceive the victim by false statements that the victim had fathered an illegitimate child. Unification is also desirable because it facilitates the drafting of provisions dealing with defenses applicable to all forms of theft and the drafting of rational punishment provisions graded according to the amount of property involved or other meaningful aspects of the offense rather than according to a technical classification whose significance is chiefly historical. Nevertheless, as appears from the theft provisions of the draft, the scope of the consolidated offense of theft cannot conveniently be defined in a single comprehensive section. When theft is accomplished by physical taking or disposition, the accompanying criminal state of mind is a purpose to apply the object permanently to the benefit of someone not entitled. On the other hand, no inquiry as to permanent benefits is called for when the actor brings about a transfer of ownership or legal rights by deception or intimidation. distinctions must be made between taking of movables and the exercise of control over immovable realty, et cetera, et cetera. And so it comes about that the unified offense of theft is described and bounded in a series of separate sections in the article, some of which bear a resemblance to earlier separate offenses. But
I'm ready to vote both ways now. Well, I feel we need something transitional in there.
Well,
how do you do? How are you going to do it? I really can't tell you. I feel it's a bit of a deep core.
Well, now, how about this, just for thinking purposes? Put a period after the thereof. And then the same, and insert, new, starting a new sentence, theft may be committed in any of the following ways, colon. Theft may be committed in any one of the following ways, colon. Now, as far as 2 through 6 are concerned, I see no problem at all, as far as they're concerned. As far as 1 is concerned, expanded, known prior to the effective date of this act as... We're getting back to the objection that Justice Sloan raised, but nevertheless, expand that by inserting, like, for example, the word larceny. And what else? I don't know. I'm not, this doesn't intrigue me particularly, but what do our drafters think about it? What do you think, Ed?
I think I agree with what Justice Sloan said, and then at the same time, I agree with his statement that we ought to do away with all of these old. Rules going back 50 or 100 years or 1,000 years, whatever it was. I really don't, I'm really torn between those two ideas of parting completely with the old and starting out new. And yet I want to see all of the loopholes plugged because I can see some sharp attorney in court with his client and saying, well, no, he was really guilty of this common law offense here, and it hasn't been dealt with in this new statute, and so turn him loose. That's what I'm afraid of. That's why I'm really don't know what I think.
Well, it seems to me that without putting a period in there, or without taking some action that's going to include just simple larceny as it now exists, we might inadvertently be limiting our theft to theft committed in any of the following ways. 1, 2, 3, 4 through 6, and before we come up with petty larceny, if it wasn't trespassory taking or common law larceny.
Well, I was thinking of shoplifting. I think shoplifting, for some reason, the back of my mind, that didn't come within the common law definition of trespassory taking, and that's why you had to have a special statute.
Yeah.
It isn't just the special punishment statutes, what a lot of those are, but that it, for some reason, didn't come within the definition. I can't remember what it was about the act that didn't constitute it, but and it doesn't constitute burglary, of course, because the entry is public place. Now, does that mean that we dropped?
Yeah, that's what I'm afraid of. And,
yeah, I'm too.
But if you said by conduct known prior to the effects of this day of this act is larceny, comma, larceny in a store, comma, larceny for a person.
Yeah,
comma. I know.
Yeah, I think
I can't do it that way.
No, I don't think we can either, and come up with any kind of a statute that's going to be comprehensible at all. Because once we start putting these things in and we're going to define it to death, it seems to me. Every time you add a word, you're going to have to define it. And I'm not, certainly not married to the language I've got in here, but all I was trying to do was to show that what had been thought of as larceny before would now be theft. And that...
But that's what I'm afraid of, is that you haven't covered every kind of larceny before.
Now, where is shoplifting in this now?
It ain't there, partner. It ain't there, partner.
Shoplifting is no longer a crime.
It's a civil offense. Breach of contract.
Well, I think you decided, didn't we decide at some point that we're just going to have to do it? Devise a shoplifting statute, right?
But
pretty much along the lines of the old one.
But we're going to have to remedy the problem that we have here, I think.
Well, I'm not so sure that larceny doesn't cover shoplifting, Kathleen.
I may have picked a bad example, but that one tickles my mind, that some reason or other, the reason that those statutes were adopted on shoplifting was for some reason it didn't fit the common law.
Because when you got into the aspartation problem, I think there was a problem of when was it when you were actually stealing it? Because you were a customer in the store and taking it, there was a difficulty of proof there to prove the aspartation and the intent. So your statutory definition of shoplifting was to cover this taking within the store, and
it was a self-interest legislation. Just like this, we had just this last week, a case involving the possession of a stolen credit card, and they were charged with the possession of stolen property. Well, the argument is made, well, the same thing, you've got two crimes charged, and one in fact, one of which is a misdemeanor and the other is a felony. And the credit card thing is just a typical example of special legislation that the people putting out credit cards thought, I assume, that they weren't adequately protected by the laws of legislation. Now,